Eric had a foolproof system for teaching the same style. "Imagine your kid is running into the street and you have to sprint after her in bare feet," Eric told me when I picked up my training with him after my time with Ken. "You'll automatically lock into perfect form. You'll be up on your forefeet with your back erect, head steady, arms high, elbows driving, and feet touching down quickly on the forefoot and kicking back toward your butt." Then, to embed that light, whispery foot strike into my muscle memory, Eric began programming workouts for me with lots of hill repeats. "You can't run uphill powerfully with poor biomechanics," Eric explained. "Just doesn't work. If you try landing on your heel with a straight leg, you'll tip over backward." Eric also had me get a heart rate monitor so I could correct the second most common mistake of the running class, pace. Most of us are just as clueless about speed as we are about form. Nearly all runners do their slow runs too fast and their fast runs too slow, Ken Murick says. So they're just training their bodies to burn sugar, which is the last thing a distance runner wants. You've got enough fat stored to run to California, so the more you train your body to burn fat instead of sugar, the longer your limited sugar tank is going to last. The way to activate your fat-burning furnace is by staying below your aerobic threshold, your hard breathing point, during your endurance runs. Respecting that speed limit was a lot easier before the birth of cushioned shoes and paved roads. Try blasting up a scree-covered trail in open-toed sandals sometime, and you'll quickly lose the temptation to open the throttle. When your feet aren't artificially protected, you're forced to vary your pace and watch your speed. The instant you get recklessly fast and sloppy, the pain shooting up your shins will slow you down. I was tempted to go the full caballo and chuck my running shoes for a pair of sandals, but Eric warned me that I was cruising for a stress fracture if I tried to suddenly go naked after keeping my feet immobilized for 40 years. Since the number one priority was getting me ready for 50 backcountry miles, I didn't have time to slowly build up foot strength before starting my serious training. I'd need to start off with some protection, so I experimented with a few low-slung models before settling on a classic I found on eBay, a pair of old-stock Nike Pegasus from 2000, something of a throwback to the flat-footed feel of the old Cortez. Footnote: Nike's policy of yanking best-selling shoes from the shelves every 10 months has inspired some truly operatic bursts of profanity on running message boards. The Nike Pegasus, for instance, debuted in 1981, achieved its sleek, waffled apotheosis in 83, and then, despite being the most popular running shoe of all time, was suddenly discontinued in 98, only to reappear as a whole new beast in 2000. Why so much surgery? Not to improve the shoe, as a former Nike shoe designer who worked on the original Pegasus told me, but to improve revenue. Nike's aim is to triple sales by enticing runners to buy 2, 3, 5 pairs at a time, stockpiling in case they never see their favorites again. By week 2, Eric was sending me off for 2 hours at a stretch, his only advice being to focus on form and keep the pace relaxed enough to occasionally breathe with my mouth shut. 50 years earlier, Arthur Lydiard offered an equal but opposite tip for managing heart rate and pace. Only go as fast as you can while holding a conversation. By week 4, Eric was layering in speed work. "The faster you can run comfortably," he taught me, "the less energy you'll need. Speed means less time on your feet." Barely 8 weeks into his program, I was already running more miles per week at a much faster pace than I ever had in my life. That's when I decided to cheat. Eric had promised that my eating would self-regulate once my mileage began climbing, but I was too doubtful to wait and see. I have a cyclist friend who dumps his water bottles before riding uphill. If 12 ounces slowed him down, it wasn't hard to calculate what 30 pounds of spare tire were doing to me. But if I was going to tinker with my diet a few months before a 50-mile race, I had to be careful to do it Tarahumara style. I had to get strong while getting lean. I tracked down Tony Ramirez, a horticulturalist in the Mexican border town of Laredo who's been traveling into Tarahumara country for 30 years and now grows Tarahumara heritage corn and grinds his own pinole. "I'm a big fan of pinole. I love it," Tony told me. "It's an incomplete protein, but combined with beans, it's more nutritious than a T-bone steak. They usually mix it with water and drink it, but I like it dry. It tastes like shredded popcorn." "Do you know about phenols?" Tony added. "They're natural plant chemicals that combat disease. They basically boost your immune system." When Cornell University researchers did a comparison analysis of wheat, oats, corn, and rice to see which had the highest quantity of phenols, corn was the hands-down winner. And because it's a low-fat, whole-grain food, pinole can slash your risk of diabetes and a host of digestive system cancers. In fact, of all cancers. According to Dr. Robert Weinberg, a professor of cancer research at MIT and discoverer of the first tumor suppressor gene, one in every seven cancer deaths is caused by excess body fat. The math is stark. Cut the fat and cut your cancer risk. So the Tarahumara miracle, when it comes to cancer, isn't such a mystery after all. Change your lifestyle, and you can reduce your risk of cancer by 60 to 70%, Dr. Weinberg has said. Colon, prostate, and breast cancer were almost unknown in Japan, he points out, until the Japanese began eating like Americans. Within a few decades, their mortality rate from those three diseases skyrocketed. When the American Cancer Society compared lean and heavy people in 2003, the results were even grimmer than expected. Heavier men and women were far more likely to die from at least 10 different kinds of cancer. The first step toward going cancer-free the Tarahumara way, consequently, is simple enough. Eat less. The second step is just as simple on paper, though tougher in practice. Eat better. Along with getting more exercise, says Dr. Weinberg, we need to build our diets around fruit and vegetables instead of red meat and processed carbs. The most compelling evidence comes from watching cancer cells fight for their own survival. When cancerous tumors are removed by surgery, they are 300% more likely to grow back in patients with a traditional Western diet than they are in patients who eat lots of fruit and veggies, according to a 2007 report by the Journal of the American Medical Association. Why? Because stray cells left behind after surgery seem to be stimulated by animal proteins. Remove those foods from your diet, and those tumors may never appear in the first place. Eat like a poor person, as Coach Joe Vigil likes to say, and you'll only see your doctor on the golf course. Anything the Tarahumara eat, you can get very easily, Tony told me. It's mostly pinto beans, squash, chili peppers, wild greens, pinole, and lots of chia. And pinole isn't as hard to get as you think. NativeSeeds.org sells it online, along with Heritage Seeds, in case you want to grow your own corn and whiz up some homemade pinole in a coffee grinder. Protein is no problem. According to a 1979 study in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, the traditional Tarahumara diet exceeds the United Nations recommended daily intake by more than 50%. As for bone-strengthening calcium, that gets worked into tortillas and pinole with the limestone the Tarahumara women use to soften the corn. How about beer? I asked. Any benefit to drinking like the Tarahumara? Yes and no, Tony said. Tarahumara tesguino is very lightly fermented, so it's low in alcohol and high in nutrients. That makes Tarahumara beer a rich food source, like a whole grain smoothie, while ours is just sugar water. I could try home brewing my own corn near beer, but Tony had a better idea. Grow some wild geranium, he suggested, or buy the extract online. Geranium nivium is the Tarahumara wonder drug. According to the Journal of Agricultural and Food Chemistry, it's as effective as red wine at neutralizing disease-causing free radicals. As one writer put it, wild geranium is anti-everything, anti-inflammatory, antiviral, antibacterial, antioxidant. I stocked up on pinole and chia and even ordered some tarahumara corn seeds to plant out back, cocopa and mayo yellow chapalote and pinole maize. But realistically, I knew it was only a matter of time before I got sick of seeds and dried corn and started double-fisting burgers again. Luckily, I spoke to Dr. Ruth Heydrich first. "Have you ever had salad for breakfast?" she asked me. Dr. Ruth is a 6-time Ironman triathlete and, according to Living Fit magazine, one of the 10 fittest women in America. She only became an athlete and a PhD in health education, she told me, after she was diagnosed with breast cancer 24 years ago. Exercise has been shown to cut the risk of breast cancer reoccurrence by up to 50%. So even with the sutures still in her chest from her mastectomy, Dr. Ruth began training for her first triathlon. She also started researching the diets of non-cancerous cultures and became convinced that she needed to immediately transition from the standard American diet, or SAD, as she calls it, and eat more like the tarahumara. "I had a medical gun at my head," Dr. Ruth told me. "I was so scared I'd have bargained with the devil. So by comparison, giving up meat wasn't that big a deal." She had a simple rule. If it came from plants, she ate it. If it came from animals, she didn't. Dr. Ruth had much more to lose than I did if she got it wrong, but almost immediately, she felt her strength increasing. Her endurance increased so dramatically that within 1 year, she'd progressed from 10Ks to marathons to the Ironman. "Even my cholesterol dropped from 230 to 160 in 21 days," she adds. Under her tarahumara-style eating plan, lunch and dinner were built around fruit, beans, yams, whole grains, and vegetables, and breakfast was often salad. "You get leafy greens in your body first thing in the morning, and you'll lose a lot of weight," she urged me. Because a monster salad is loaded with nutrient-rich carbs and low in fat, I could stuff myself and not feel hungry or queasy when it came time to work out. Plus, greens are packed with water, so they're great for rehydrating after a night's sleep. And what better way to down your 5 vegetables a day than forking them all down at once? So the next morning, I gave it a stab. I wandered around the kitchen with a mixing bowl, throwing in my daughter's half-eaten apple, some kidney beans of questionable vintage, a bunch of raw spinach, and a ton of broccoli, which I chopped into splinters, hoping to make it more like coleslaw. Dr. Ruth fancies up her salads with blackstrap molasses, but I figured I'd earned the extra fat and sugar, so I went upscale, dousing mine with gourmet poppy seed dressing. After 2 bites, I was a convert. A breakfast salad, I was happy to find, is also a sweet topping delivery system, just like pancakes and syrup. It's far more refreshing than frozen waffles, and best of all, I could cram myself till my eyes were green and still shoot out the door for a workout an hour later. "The tarahumara aren't great runners," Eric messaged me as we began my second month of those workouts. "They're great athletes, and those two things are very different. Runners are assembly line workers. They become good at one thing, moving straight ahead at a steady speed, and repeat that motion until overuse fritzes out the machinery. Athletes are Tarzans. Tarzan swims and wrestles and jumps and swings on vines. He's strong and explosive. You never know what Tarzan will do next, which is why he never gets hurt. Your body needs to be shocked to become resilient," Eric explained. "Follow the same daily routine, and your musculoskeletal system quickly figures out how to adapt and go on autopilot. But surprise it with new challenges. Leap over a creek, commando crawl under a log, sprint till your lungs are bursting, and scores of nerves and ancillary muscles are suddenly electrified into action. For the tarahumara, that's just daily life. The tarahumara step into the unknown every time they leave the cave, because they never know how fast they'll have to sprint after a rabbit, how much firewood they'll have to haul home, how tricky the climbing will be during a winter storm. The first challenge they face as kids is surviving on the edge of a cliff. Their first and lifelong way to play is the ball game, which is nothing if not an exercise in uncertainty. You can't drive a wooden ball over a jumble of rocks unless you're ready to lunge, lope, backpedal, sprint, and leap in and out of ditches. Before the tarahumara run long, they get strong. And if I wanted to stay healthy, Eric warned me, I'd better do likewise. So instead of stretching before a run, I got right to work. Lunges, push-ups, jump squats, crunches. Eric had me powering through a half hour of raw strength drills every other day, with nearly all of them on a fitness ball to sharpen my balance and fire those supportive ancillary muscles. As soon as I finished, it was off to the hills. There's no sleepwalking your way up a hill, Eric pointed out. Long climbs were an exercise in shock and awe, forcing me to focus on form and shift gears like a Tour de France cyclist. Hills are speed work in disguise, Frank Shorter used to say. That was the year my hometown in Pennsylvania got a heat flash for Christmas. On New Year's Day, I pulled on shorts and a thermal top for a 5-mile trail run, just an easy leg stretcher on a rest day. I rambled through the woods for half an hour, then cut through a field of winter hay and headed for home. The warm sun and the aroma of sun-baked grass were so luxurious, I kept slowing down, dragging out that last half mile as long as I could. When I got within 100 yards of my house, I stopped, shucked my thermal shirt, and turned back for one last lap through the hay. I finished that one and started another, tossing my t-shirt aside as well. By lap 4, my socks and running shoes were on the pile, my bare feet cushioned by dry grass and warm dirt. By lap 6, I was fingering my waistband but decided to keep the shorts out of consideration for my 82-year-old neighbor. I'd finally recovered that feeling I'd had during my run with Caballo, the easy, light, smooth, fast sensation that I could outrun the sun and still be going by morning. Like Caballo, the tarahumara secret had begun working for me before I even understood it. Because I was eating lighter and hadn't been laid up once by injury, I was able to run more. Because I was running more, I was sleeping great, feeling relaxed, and watching my resting heart rate drop. My personality had even changed. The grouchiness and temper I'd considered part of my Irish-Italian DNA had ebbed so much that my wife remarked, "Hey, if this comes from ultra running, I'll tie your shoes for you." I knew aerobic exercise was a powerful antidepressant, but I hadn't realized it could be so profoundly mood-stabilizing and, I hate to use the word, meditative. If you don't have answers to your problems after a 4-hour run, you ain't getting them. I kept waiting for all the old ghosts of the past to come roaring out, the screaming Achilles, the ripped hamstring, the plantar fasciitis. I started carrying my cell phone on the longer runs, convinced that any day now I'd end up a limping mess by the side of the road. Whenever I felt a twinge, I ran through my diagnostics. Back straight? Check. Knees bent and driving forward? Check. Heels flicking back? There's your problem. Once I made the adjustment, the hot spot always eased and disappeared. By the time Eric bumped me up to 5-hour runs in the last month before the race, ghosts and cell phone were forgotten. For the first time in my life, I was looking forward to super long runs not with dread, but anticipation. How had Barefoot Ted put it? Like fish slipping back into water. Exactly. I felt like I was born to run. And, according to 3 maverick scientists, I was. Chapter 28. 20 years earlier, in a tiny basement lab, a young scientist stared into a corpse and saw his destiny staring back. At that moment, David Carrier was an undergraduate at the University of Utah. He was puzzling over a rabbit carcass, trying to figure out what the deal was with those bony things right over the butt. The bony things bugged him because they weren't supposed to be there. David was the star student in Professor Dennis Bramble's evolutionary biology class, and he knew exactly what he was supposed to see whenever he cut into a mammal's abdomen. Those big belly muscles on the diaphragm? They need to anchor down on something strong so they connect to the lumbar vertebra, just the way you'd lash a sail down to a boom. That's how it is for every mammal from a whale to a wombat, but not, apparently, for this rabbit. Instead of grabbing hold of something sturdy, its belly muscles were connected to these flimsy chicken wing-looking things. David pushed one with his finger. Cool. It compressed like a slinky, then sprang back out. But why, in all mammaldom, would a jackrabbit need a spring-loaded belly? That made me start thinking about what they do when they run, the way they arch their backs with every galloping stride, Carrier later told me. When they push off with their hind legs, they extend the back, and as soon as they land on the front legs, the back bends dorsally. Lots of mammals jackknife their bodies the same way, he mused. Even whales and dolphins move their tails up and down, while a shark slashes from side to side. Think of an inchworming cheetah movement, David says. Classic example. Good. This was good. David was getting somewhere. Big cats and little rabbits run the same way, but one has slinkies stuck to its diaphragm and one doesn't. One is fast, but the other has to be faster, at least for a little while. And why? Simple economics. If mountain lions ran down all the rabbits, you'd have no more rabbits, and eventually no more mountain lions. But jackrabbits are born with a big problem. Unlike other running animals, they don't have reserve artillery. They don't have antlers or horns or hard-kicking hooves, and they don't travel in the protection of herds. For rabbits, it's all or nothing. Either they dart their way to safety or they're cat food. Okay, David thought, maybe the slinkies have something to do with speed. So what makes you so fast? David began ticking off components. Let's see. You need an aerodynamic body, awesome reflexes, power-loaded haunches, high-volume capillaries, fast-twitch muscle fiber, small, nimble feet, rubbery tendons that return elastic energy, skinny muscles near the paws, beefy muscles near the joints. Damn! It didn't take David long to figure out he was heading toward a dead end. A lot of factors contribute to speed, and jackrabbits share most of them with their hunters. Instead of finding out how they were different, he was finding out how they were alike. So he tried a trick Dr. Bramble had taught him. When you can't answer the question, flip it over. Forget what makes something go fast. What makes it slow down? After all, it didn't just matter how fast a rabbit could go, but how fast it could keep going until it found a hole to dive down. Now that one was easy. Other than a lasso around the leg, the quickest way to bring a fast-moving mammal to a halt is by cutting off its wind. No more air equals no more speed. Try sprinting while holding your breath sometime and see how far you get. Your muscles need oxygen to burn calories and convert them into energy. So the better you are at exchanging gases, sucking in oxygen, blowing out carbon dioxide, the longer you can sustain your top speed. That's why Tour de France cyclists keep getting caught with other people's blood in their veins. Those illicit transfusions pack in extra red blood cells, which carry lots of extra oxygen to their muscles. Wait a second. That meant that for a jackrabbit to stay one hop ahead of those snapping jaws, it would need a little more air than the big mammal on its tail. David had a vision of a Victorian flying machine. One of those wacky but plausible contraptions rigged with pistons and steam valves and endless mazes of wheezing levers. Levers. Those slinkies were beginning to make sense. They had to be levers that turbocharged the rabbit's lungs, pumping them in and out like a fireplace bellows. David ran the numbers to see if his theory held up, and bingo! There it was, as elegant and niftily balanced as an Aesop's fable. Jackrabbits can hit 45 miles per hour, but due to the extra energy needed to operate the levers, among other things, they can only sustain it for a half mile. Cougars, coyotes, and foxes, on the other hand, can go a lot farther, but top out at 40 miles per. The slinkies balance the game, giving the otherwise defenseless jackrabbits exactly 45 seconds to either live or die. Seek shelter quickly and live long, young thumper. Or get cocky about your speed and be dead in less than a minute. You know, he thought, if you take away the levers, isn't it the same engineering for every other mammal? Maybe that's why their diaphragms hooked on to the lumbar vertebra. Not because the vertebra was sturdy and wouldn't move, but because it was stretchy and would, because it flexed. It seemed obvious that when the animal pushed off and extended its back, it wasn't just for propulsion, it was also for respiration, David says. He imagined an antelope racing for its life across a dusty savanna and behind it a streaking blur. He focused on the blur, froze it in place, then clicked it forward a frame at a time. Click. As the cheetah stretches long for a stride, its rib cage is pulled back, sucking air into the lungs, and click. Now the front legs whip back until front and rear paws are touching. The cheetah's spine bends, squeezing the chest cavity and squishing the lungs empty of air, and there you had it. Another Victorian breathing contraption, albeit with a little less turbo power. David's heart was racing. Air. Our bodies were all about getting air. Flip the equation, as Dr. Bramble had taught him, and you have this. Getting air may have determined the way we got our bodies. God, it was so simple and so mind-blowing. Because if David was right, he'd just solved the greatest mystery in human evolution. No one had ever figured out why early humans had separated themselves from all creation by taking their knuckles off the ground and standing up. It was to breathe, to open their throats, swell out their chests, and suck in air better than any other creature on the planet. But that was just the beginning. Because the better you are at breathing, David quickly realized, the better you are at running? You're saying humans evolved to go running? Dr. Dennis Bramble listened with interest as David Carrier explained his theory. Then he casually took aim and blew it to smithereens. He tried to be gentle. David was a brilliant student with a truly original mind, but this time, Bramble suspected, he'd fallen victim to the most common mistake in science, the handy hammer syndrome, in which the hammer in your hand makes everything look like a nail. Dr. Bramble knew a little about David's life outside the classroom and was aware that on sunny spring afternoons, David loved to bolt from the labs and go trail running in the Wasatch Mountains, which lap right up to the back of the University of Utah campus. Dr. Bramble was a runner himself, so he understood the attraction. But you had to be careful with stuff like that. A biologist's biggest occupational hazard, second only to falling in love with your research assistants, was falling in love with your hobbies. You become your own test subject. You start seeing the world as a reflection of your own life, and your own life as a reference point for just about every phenomenon in the world. David, Dr. Bramble began, species evolve according to what they're good at, not what they're bad at. And as runners, humans aren't just bad, we're awful. You didn't even need to get into the biology. You could just look at cars and motorcycles. Four wheels are faster than two, because as soon as you go upright, you lose thrust, stability, and aerodynamics. Now transfer that design to animals. A tiger is 10 feet long and shaped like a cruise missile. It's the drag racer of the jungle. While humans have to putter along with their skinny legs, tiny strides, and piss-poor wind resistance. Yeah, I get it, David said. Once we came up off our knuckles, everything went to hell. We lost raw speed and upper body power. Good kid, Bramble thought. Learns quick. But David wasn't done. So why, David continued, would we give up strength and speed at the same time? That left us unable to run, unable to fight, unable to climb and hide in the tree canopy. We'd have been wiped out, unless we got something pretty amazing in exchange, right? That, Dr. Bramble had to admit, was a damn clever way to put the question. Cheetahs are fast but frail. They have to hunt by day to avoid nocturnal killers like lions and panthers, and they abandon their kills and run for cover when scrappy little thugs like hyenas show up. A gorilla, on the other hand, is strong enough to lift a 4,000-pound SUV, but with a gorilla's land speed of 20 miles per hour, that same SUV could run it over in first gear. And then we have humans, who are part cheetah, part gorilla. We're slow and wimpy. So why would we evolve into a weaker creature instead of a stronger one? David persisted. This was long before we could make weapons, So what was the genetic advantage? Dr. Bramble played the scenario out in his head. He imagined a tribe of primitive hominids, all squat, quick, and powerful, keeping their heads low for safety as they scrambled nimbly through the trees. One day, out pops a slow, skinny, sunken-chested son who's barely bigger than a woman and keeps making a tiger target out of himself by walking around in the open. He's too frail to fight, too slow to run away, too weak to attract a mate who will bear him children. By all logic, he's marked for extinction. Yet somehow, this dweeb becomes the father of all mankind, while his stronger, swifter brothers disappear into oblivion. That hypothetical account was actually a pretty accurate description of the Neanderthal riddle. Most people think Neanderthals were our ancestors, but they were actually a parallel species, or subspecies, some say, that competed with Homo sapiens for survival. Competed, actually, is being kind. The Neanderthals had us beat any way you keep score. They were stronger, tougher, and probably smarter. They had burlier muscles, harder to break bones, better natural insulation against the cold, and, the fossil record suggests, a bigger brain. Neanderthals were fantastically gifted hunters and skilled weapon makers, and may very well have acquired language before we did. They had a huge head start in the race for world domination. By the time the first Homo sapiens appeared in Europe, Neanderthals had already been cozily established there for nearly 200,000 years. If you had to choose between Neanderthals and early us in a last man standing contest, you'd go Neanderthal all the way. So, where are they? Within 10,000 years of the arrival of Homo sapiens in Europe, the Neanderthals vanished. How it happened, no one knows. The only explanation is that some mysterious X factor gave us, the weaker, dumber, skinnier creatures, a life-or-death edge over the Ice Age all-stars. It wasn't strength. It wasn't weapons. It wasn't intelligence. Could it have been running ability? Dr. Bramble wondered. Is David really on to something? There was only one way to find out. Go to the bones. At first, I was very skeptical of David, for the same reason most morphologists would be, Dr. Bramble later told me. Morphology is basically the science of reverse engineering. It looks at how a body is assembled and tries to figure out how it's supposed to function. Morphologists know what to look for in a fast-moving machine, and in no way did the human body match the specs. All you had to do was look at our butts to figure that out. In the whole history of vertebrates on Earth, the whole history, humans are the only running biped that's tailless, Bramble would later say. Running is just a controlled fall. So how do you steer and keep from smacking down on your face without a weighted rudder like a kangaroo's tail? That's what led me, like others, to dismiss the idea that humans evolved as running animals, Bramble said. And I would have bought into the story and remained a skeptic if I hadn't also been trained in paleontology. Dr. Bramble's secondary expertise in fossils allowed him to compare how the human blueprint had been modified over the millennia and check it against other designs. Right off the bat, he began finding things that didn't fit. Instead of looking at the conventional list, like most morphologists, and ticking off the things I expected to see, I began focusing on the abnormalities, Bramble said. In other words, what's there that shouldn't be there? He began by splitting the animal kingdom into two categories, runners and walkers. Runners include horses and dogs. Walkers are pigs and chimps. If humans were designed to walk most of the time and run only in emergencies, our mechanical parts should match up pretty closely to those of other walkers. Common chimps were the perfect place to start. Not only are they a classic example of the walking animal, but they're also our closest living relative. After more than 6 million years of separate evolution, we still share 95% of our DNA sequence with chimps. But what we don't share, Bramble noted, is an Achilles tendon, which connects the calf to the heel. We've got one. Chimps don't. We have very different feet. Ours are arched. Chimps are flat. Our toes are short and straight, which helps running, while chimps are long and splayed, much better for walking. And check out our butts. We've got a hefty gluteus maximus. Chimps have virtually none. Dr. Bramble then focused on a little-known tendon behind the head, known as the nuchal ligament. Chimps don't have a nuchal ligament. Neither do pigs. Know who does? Dogs, horses, and humans. Now this was perplexing. The nuchal ligament is useful only for stabilizing the head when an animal is moving fast. If you're a walker, you don't need one. Big butts are only necessary for running. See for yourself. Clutch your butt and walk around the room sometime. It'll stay soft and fleshy and only tighten up when you start to run. Your butt's job is to prevent the momentum of your upper body from flipping you onto your face. Likewise, the Achilles tendon serves no purpose at all in walking, which is why chimps don't have one. Neither did Australopithecus, our semi-simian 4-million-year-old ancestor. Evidence of an Achilles tendon only began to appear 2 million years later, in Homo erectus. Dr. Bramble then took a closer look at the skulls and got a jolt. Holy moly, he thought. There's something going on here. The back of the Australopithecus skull was smooth, but when he checked Homo erectus, he found a shallow groove for a nuchal ligament. A mystifying but unmistakable timeline was taking shape. As the human body changed over time, it adopted key features of a running animal. Weird, Bramble thought. How come we acquired all this specialized running stuff and other walkers didn't? For a walking animal, the Achilles would just be a liability. Moving on two legs is like walking on stilts. You plant your foot, pivot your body weight over the leg, and repeat. The last thing you'd want would be stretchy, wobbly tendons right at your base of support. All an Achilles tendon does is stretch like a rubber band. A rubber band! Dr. Bramble felt twin surges of pride and embarrassment. Rubber bands! There he'd been, thumping his chest about not being like all those other morphologists who tick off the things they expect to see, when all along he'd been just as misguided by myopia. He hadn't even thought about the rubber band factor. When David started talking about running, Dr. Bramble assumed he meant speed. But there are two kinds of great runners, sprinters and marathoners. Maybe human running was about going far, not fast. That would explain why our feet and legs are so dense with springy tendons, because springy tendons store and return energy, just like the rubber band propellers on balsa wood airplanes. The more you twist the rubber band, the farther the plane flies. Likewise, the more you can stretch the tendons, the more free energy you get when that leg extends and swings back. And if I were going to design a long-distance running machine, Dr. Bramble thought, that's exactly what I'd load it with. Lots of rubber bands to maximize endurance. Running is really just jumping, springing from one foot to another. Tendons are irrelevant to walking, but great for energy-efficient jumping. So forget speed. Maybe we were born to be the world's greatest marathoners. And you've got to ask yourself why only one species in the world has the urge to gather by the tens of thousands to run 26 miles in the heat for fun, Dr. Bramble mused. Recreation has its reasons. Together, Dr. Bramble and David Carrier began putting their world's greatest marathoner model to the test. Soon, evidence was turning up all over, even in places they weren't looking. One of their first big discoveries came by accident when David took a horse for a jog. "We wanted to videotape a horse to see how its gait coordinated with its breathing," Dr. Bramble says. "We needed someone to keep the gear from getting tangled, so David ran alongside it." When they played back the tape, something seemed strange, although Bramble couldn't figure out what it was. He had to rewind a few times before it hit him. Even though David and the horse were moving at the same speed, David's legs were moving more slowly. "It was astonishing," Dr. Bramble explains. "Even though the horse has long legs, and four of them, David had a longer stride." David was in great shape for a scientist, but as a medium-height, medium-weight, middle-of-the-pack runner, he was perfectly average. That left only one explanation. As bizarre as it may seem, the average human has a longer stride than a horse. The horse looks like it's taking giant lunges forward, but its hooves swing back before touching the ground. The result, even though biomechanically smooth human runners have short strides, they still cover more distance per step than a horse, making them more efficient. With equal amounts of gas in the tank, in other words, a human can theoretically run farther than a horse. But why settle for theory when you can put it to the test? Every October, a few dozen runners and riders face off in the 50-mile man-against-horse race in Prescott, Arizona. In 1999, a local runner named Paul Bonnet passed the lead horses on the steep climb up Mingus Mountain and never saw them again till after he'd crossed the finish line. The following year, Dennis Pulheko began a remarkable streak. He beat every man, woman, and steed for the next 6 years, until Paul Bonnet wrested the title back in 2006. It would take 8 years before a horse finally caught up with those two and won again. Discoveries like these, however, were just happy little extras for the two Utah scientists as they tunneled closer to their big breakthrough. As David had suspected on the day he peered into a rabbit's carcass and saw the history of life staring back at him, evolution seemed to be all about air. The more highly evolved the species, the better its carburetor. Take reptiles. David put lizards on a treadmill and found they can't even run and breathe at the same time. The best they can manage is a quick scramble before stopping to pant. Dr. Bramble, meanwhile, was working a little higher up the evolutionary ladder with big cats. He discovered that when many quadrupeds run, their internal organs slosh back and forth like water in a bathtub. Every time a cheetah's front feet hit the ground, its guts slam forward into the lungs, forcing out air. When it reaches out for the next stride, its innards slide rearward, sucking air back in. Adding that extra punch to their lung power, though, comes at a cost. It limits cheetahs to just one breath per stride. Actually, Dr. Bramble was surprised to find that all running mammals are restricted to the same cycle of take a step, take a breath. In the entire world, he and David could only find one exception. You. When quadrupeds run, they get stuck in a one breath per locomotion cycle, Dr. Bramble said. But the human runners we tested never went one to one. They could pick from a number of different ratios and generally preferred 2-to-1. The reason we're free to pant to our heart's content is the same reason you need a shower on a summer day. We're the only mammals that shed most of our heat by sweating. All the pelt-covered creatures in the world cool off primarily by breathing, which locks their entire heat-regulating system to their lungs. But humans, with our millions of sweat glands, are the best air-cooled engine that evolution has ever put on the market. That's the benefit of being a naked, sweating animal, David Carrier explains. As long as we keep sweating, we can keep going. A team of Harvard scientists had once verified exactly that point by sticking a rectal thermometer in a cheetah and getting it to run on a treadmill. Once its temperature hit 105 degrees, the cheetah shut down and refused to run. That's the natural response for all running mammals. When they build up more heat in their bodies than they can puff out their mouths, they have to stop or die. Fantastic! Springy legs, twiggy torsos, sweat glands, hairless skin, vertical bodies that retain less sun heat. No wonder we're the world's greatest marathoners. But so what? Natural selection is all about two things, eating and not getting eaten. And being able to run 20 miles ain't worth a damn if the deer disappears in the first 20 seconds and a tiger can catch you in 10. What good is endurance on a battlefield built on speed? That's the question Dr. Bramble was mulling in the early 90s when he was on sabbatical and met Dr. Dan Lieberman during a visit to Harvard. At the time, Lieberman was working on the other end of the Animal Olympics. He had a pig on a treadmill and was trying to figure out why it was such a lousy runner. "Take a look at its head," Bramble pointed out. "It wobbles all over the place. Pigs don't have a nuchal ligament." Lieberman's ears perked up. As an evolutionary anthropologist, he knew that nothing on our bodies has changed as much as the shape of our skulls, or says more about who we are. Even your breakfast burrito plays a role. Lieberman's investigations had revealed that as our diet shifted over the centuries from chewy stuff like raw roots and wild game, and gave way to mushy cooked staples like spaghetti and ground beef, our faces began to shrink. Ben Franklin's face was chunkier than yours. Caesar's was bigger than his. The Harvard and Utah scientists got along right from the start, mostly because of Lieberman's eyes. They didn't roll when Bramble briefed him on the running man theory. No one in the scientific community was willing to take it seriously, Bramble said. For every one paper on running, there were 4,000 on walking. Whenever I'd bring it up at conferences, everyone would always say, "Yeah, but we're slow." They were focused on speed and couldn't understand how endurance could be an advantage. Well, to be fair, Bramble hadn't really figured that one out yet either. As biologists, he and David Carrier could decipher how the machine was designed, but they needed an anthropologist to determine what that design could actually do. "I knew a lot about evolution and a little about locomotion," Lieberman says. "Dennis knew a shitload about locomotion, but not so much about evolution." As they traded stories and ideas, Bramble could tell that Lieberman was his kind of lab partner. Lieberman was a scientist who believed that being hands-on meant being prepared to soak them in blood. For years, Lieberman had organized a Cro-Magnon barbecue on a Harvard yard lawn as part of his human evolution class. To demonstrate the dexterity necessary to operate primitive tools, he'd get his students to butcher a goat with sharpened stones, then cook it in a pit. As soon as the aroma of roasting goats spread and the post-butchering libations began flowing, homework turned into a house party. "It eventually evolved into a kind of bacchanalian feast," Lieberman told the Harvard University Gazette. But there was an even more important reason that Lieberman was the perfect guy to tackle the running man mystery. The solution seemed to be linked to his specialty, the head. Everyone knew that at some point in history, early humans got access to a big supply of protein, which allowed their brains to expand like a thirsty sponge in a bucket of water. Our brains kept growing until they were 7 times larger than the brains of any comparable mammal. They also sucked up an ungodly number of calories. Even though our brains account for only 2% of our body weight, they demand 20% of our energy, compared with just 9% for chimps. Dr. Lieberman threw himself into running man research with his usual creative zeal. Soon, students dropping by Lieberman's office on the top floor of Harvard's Peabody Museum were startled to find a sweat-drenched, one-armed man with an empty cream cheese cup strapped to his head, running on a treadmill. "We humans are weird," Lieberman said as he punched the buttons on the control panel. "No other creature has been found with a neck like ours." He paused to shout a question to the man on the treadmill. "How much faster can you go, Willie?" "Faster than this thing," Willie called back, his steel left hand clanging against the treadmill rail. Willie Stewart lost his arm when he was 18 after a steel cable he was carrying on a construction job got caught in a whirling turbine, but he recovered to become a champion triathlete and rugby player. In addition to the cream cheese cup, which was being used to secure a gyroscope, Willie also had electrodes taped to his chest and legs. Dr. Lieberman had recruited him to test his theory that the human head, with its unique position directly on top of the neck, acts like the roof weights used to prevent skyscrapers from pitching in the wind. "Our heads didn't just expand because we got better at running," Lieberman believed. "We got better at running because our heads were expanding, thereby providing more ballast." "Your head works with your arms to keep you from twisting and swaying in mid-stride," Dr. Lieberman said. "The arms, meanwhile, also work as a counterbalance to keep the head aligned. That's how bipeds solved the problem of how to stabilize a head with a movable neck. It's yet another feature of human evolution that only makes sense in terms of running." But the big mystery continued to be food. Judging by the Godzilla-like growth of our heads, Lieberman could pinpoint the exact moment when the caveman menu changed. It had to be 2 million years ago, when ape-like Australopithecus, with his tiny brain, giant jaw, and billy goat diet of tough, fibrous plants, evolved into Homo erectus, our slim, long-legged ancestor with the big head and small, tearing teeth perfectly suited for raw flesh and soft fruits. Only one thing could have sparked such a dramatic makeover: a diet no primate had ever eaten before, featuring a reliable supply of meat with its high concentrations of calories, fat, and protein. "So where the fuck did they get it?" Lieberman asks, with all the gusto of a man who's not squeamish about hacking into goats with a rock. "The bow and arrow is 20,000 years old. The spearhead is 200,000 years old. But Homo erectus is around 2 million years old. That means that for most of our existence, for nearly 2 million years, hominids were getting meat with their bare hands." Lieberman began playing the possibilities out in his mind. "Maybe we pirated carcasses killed by other predators?" he asked himself. "Scooting in and grabbing them while the lion was sleeping? No, that would give us an appetite for meat, but not dependable access. You'd have to get to a kill site before the vultures, who can strip an antelope in minutes and chew bones like crackers, as Lieberman likes to say. Even then, you might only tear off a few mouthfuls before the lion opened a baleful eye or a pack of hyenas drove you away. Okay, maybe we didn't have spears, but we could have jumped on a boar and throttled it, or clubbed it to death. Are you kidding? With all that thrashing and goring, you'd get your feet crushed, your testicles torn, your ribs broken. You'd win, but you'd pay for it. Break an ankle in the prehistoric wilderness while hunting for dinner, and you might become dinner yourself." There's no telling how long Lieberman would have remained stumped if his dog hadn't finally given him the answer. One summer afternoon, Lieberman took Vashti, his muddy half-border collie, for a 5-mile jog around Fresh Pond. It was hot, and after a few miles, Vashti plopped down under a tree and refused to move. Lieberman got impatient. Yeah, it was a little warm, but not that bad. As he waited for his panting dog to cool off, Lieberman's mind flashed back to his time doing fossil research in Africa. He recalled the shimmering waves across the sun-scorched savanna, the way the dry clay soaked up the heat and beamed it right back up through the soles of his boots. Ethnographers' reports he'd read years ago began flooding his mind. They told of African hunters who used to chase antelope across the savannas, and Tarahumara Indians who would race after a deer until its hooves fell off. Lieberman had always shrugged them off as tall tales, fables of a golden age of heroes who'd never really existed. But now he started to wonder. "So how long would it take to actually run an animal to death?" he asked himself. Luckily, the Harvard Biolabs have the best locomotive research in the world, as their willingness to insert a thermometer in a cheetah's butt should make clear. So all the data Lieberman needed was right at his fingertips. When he got back to his office, he began punching in numbers. "Let's see," he began. "A jogger in decent shape averages about 3 to 4 meters a second. A deer trots at almost the identical pace. But here's the kicker. When a deer wants to accelerate to 4 meters a second, it has to break into a heavy breathing gallop, while a human can go just as fast and still be in his jogging zone. A deer is way faster at a sprint, but we're faster at a jog. So when Bambi is already edging into oxygen debt, we're barely breathing hard." Lieberman kept looking and found an even more telling comparison. The top galloping speed for most horses is 7.7 meters a second. They can hold that pace for about 10 minutes, then have to slow to 5.8 meters a second. But an elite marathoner can jog for hours at 6 meters a second. The horse will erupt away from the starting line, as Dennis Pulheiko had discovered in the Man Against Horse race, but with enough patience and distance, you can slowly close the gap. You don't even have to go fast, Lieberman realized. All you have to do is keep the animal in sight, and within 10 minutes, you're reeling him in. Lieberman began calculating temperatures, speed, and body weight. Soon, there it was before him, the solution to the running man mystery. To run an antelope to death, Lieberman determined, all you have to do is scare it into a gallop on a hot day. If you keep just close enough for it to see you, it will keep sprinting away. After about 10 or 15 kilometers worth of running, it will go into hyperthermia and collapse. Translation: if you can run 6 miles on a summer day, then you, my friend, are a lethal weapon in the animal kingdom. We can dump heat on the run, but animals can't pant while they gallop. We can run in conditions that no other animal can run in, Lieberman realized, and it's not even hard. If a middle-aged professor can outrun a dog on a hot day, imagine what a pack of motivated hunter-gatherers could do to an overheated antelope. It's easy to picture the scorn on the faces of those masters of the universe, the Neanderthals, as they watch these new running men puffing along behind bouncy little Bambis, or jogging all day under a hot sun to return with nothing but an armload of yams. The running men could get a load of meat by running, but they couldn't run with a belly load of meat. So most of the time they carbo-loaded on roots and fruits, saving the antelope chops for special calorie-boosting occasions. Everyone scavenged together, running men, running women, running kids, and grampies. But despite all that team activity, they were more likely to dine on grubs than wild game. Blech! Neanderthals wouldn't touch bugs and dirt food. They ate meat and only meat. And not gristly little antelopes either. Neanderthals went grade A all the way. Bears, bison, and elk marbled with juicy fat. Rhinos with livers rich in iron. Mammoths with luscious, oily brains and bones dripping with lip-smacking marrow. Try chasing monsters like those, though, and they'll be chasing you. Instead, you've got to outsmart and outfight them. The Neanderthals would lure them into ambushes and launch a pincer attack, storming from all sides with 8-foot wooden lances. Hunting like that isn't for the meek. Neanderthals were known to suffer the kind of injuries you find on the rodeo circuit, neck and head trauma from getting thrown by bucking beasts, but they could count on their band of brothers to care for their wounds and bury their bodies. Unlike our true ancestors, those scampering running men, the Neanderthals were the mighty hunters we like to imagine we once were. They stood shoulder to shoulder in battle, a united front of brains and bravery, clever warriors armored with muscle but still refined enough to slow cook their meat to tenderness in earth ovens and keep their women and children away from the danger. Neanderthals ruled the world till it started getting nice outside. About 45,000 years ago, the long winter ended and a hot front moved in. The forests shrank, leaving behind parched grasslands stretching to the horizon. The new climate was great for the running men. The antelope herds exploded and feasts of plump roots were pushing up all over the savanna. The Neanderthals had it tougher. Their long spears and canyon ambushes were useless against the fleet prairie creatures, and the big game they preferred was retreating deeper into the dwindling forests. Well, why didn't they just adopt the hunting strategy of the running men? They were smart and certainly strong enough, but that was the problem. They were too strong. Once temperatures climb above 90 degrees Fahrenheit, a few extra pounds of body weight make a huge difference. So much so that to maintain heat balance, a 160-pound runner would lose nearly 3 minutes per mile in a marathon against a 100-pound runner. In a 2-hour pursuit of a deer, the running men would leave the Neanderthal competition more than 10 miles behind. Smothered in muscle, the Neanderthals followed the mastodons into the dying forest and oblivion. The new world was made for runners, and running just wasn't their thing. Privately, David Carrier knew the running man theory had a fatal flaw. The secret gnawed until it nearly turned him into a killer. "Yeah, I was kind of obsessed," he admitted when I met him at his last.